Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. I've got our, you know, monthly gathering of the news in the art and collectible and good stuff world. And I thought Richard and I will tell you what's been going on in those worlds. And if Richard's got any comments, I'm hoping he'll chime in. But I want to start off by something that surprised me greatly. I think everybody that listens knew that Churchill, the great diplomat, et cetera, from the Second World War in England, Winston Churchill was also a pretty good artist. And he painted in both oil and watercolor. And one of his canvases recently sold for $11.5 million. Now, if you ask me, well, is it a good canvas? Well, I suppose it's well done. But the issue is, of course, he's Winston Churchill. Anyway, another canvas of the same image, which is his favorite city. Believe it or not, he painted this city again and again as his favorite place in the world. It was Marrakesh. And this particular canvas, Marrakesh, is being offered by M.S. Rao. And Rao is a famous, I guess you could say, provisioner of the finest of the fine in New Orleans. And I always love looking at what that shop has to offer. But they're offering now Winston Churchill, price to be told when you are interested. So, you know, the actual fun thing about this particular oil that they're offering is that the oil was in the background while Winston was painting it for the sitting of Life magazine's cover in 1946. And there's the picture of Winston, the picture that he's working on the oil in his studio, in, you know, the famous mansion in which he lived in the 40s. So that's something that's really cool that that's happening. Also, I don't know if everybody's as old as I am, but I remember Culture Club and Boy George. And I'm a fashion person. I love, you know, great clothes. Boy George had some incredible Galliano, Gaudier design clothes in the 80s when, you know, 80s, I mean, the clothes in the 80s were amazing. And they're having a resurgence now. But Boy George's collection is being auctioned off in Los Angeles at Julian's Auction on July 14th. And they're going to be, you know, hats that he, you know, he always wore those oversized hats. And oversized shirts and blouses and dresses and oversized trench coats, etc. All those are going to be auctioned. Probably most of them are going to be right around the mid-80s, 1980s, at Julian's Auction in L.A. Going to be a cool auction. I'd love to have one of his hats. When you bid at auction like that, there's a limit. You know, you can't go below a certain figure. But in many cases, you can, if there's no they call it a reserve, on a particular object. So you could get really lucky. You can go to Julian's, J-U-L-I-E-N-S, online and take a look at Boy George collection. Also in Los Angeles, trying to get down there before too long, Realms of the Dharma, a great show that's all Buddhist art, curated and pulled together by the Los Angeles County Museum. That's closing middle of July. And I must say, if you haven't been down to see the David Geffen galleries, I would suggest you look into that, because Los Angeles County Museum is making it so accessible to go. For example, I haven't been walking very well lately. And so when I called, they were like, okay, we've got a special place for you to park. You know, you could reserve for the day if you're going to come to see this particular show, for example, or you're coming to see the Geffen Galleries. May we suggest, you know, you enter at this entrance. It's a shorter walk. And then also, if you would like, we can have you with a special wheelchair and a special attendant, or you can bring your own for free. I mean, they just, their membership office was incredibly obliging. They're working so hard to make it be the People's Museum. And along with that, they're doing a whole series at the Hollywood Bowl as well. So they're doing things on the street outside on Wilshire Boulevard. But they're also doing things, you know, throughout Los Angeles to make sure that you understand Los Angeles County Museum is really the museum for the people. Likewise, they're doing a Wes Anderson, favorite movie guy. They're doing a whole show at the Hollywood Bowl of his favorite songs from his movies, for example, and music at the Hollywood Bowl by LACMA, by Los Angeles County Museum. Really cool thing. And Richard, if you want to get me a birthday present, you can get me a couple tickets at Bellascardo here in Santa Barbara on August the 4th. It's going to be a celebration for Fiesta of Flamenco. They're bringing in dancers from Cuba, from Spain, and high-level performers, very high-level performers, people that have danced all over the world. And for some reason, they are coming to Bellascardo. Well, who wouldn't want to come to Bellascardo for just a members-only performance on August the 4th? And this is hosted by our own Santa Barbara. It's called Flamenco !! Santa Barbara. And it's headed by Maria Bermudez. And she's headed up this particular show of some of the world's best flamenco dancers, featuring my favorite Santa Barbara dancer, Jack Harwood. He goes by Jack Joaquin Harwood. He was, if you saw Fiesta del Noches here at the Mission, he was the 2023 Spirit of Fiesta. He was the first male spirit ever in Santa Barbara. So he's a flamenco dancer. And I ran into his mom, who's the director of the Historical Museum here, asked her, how's Jack doing? Where is he going? Well, she told me he was in New York, a finalist in the New York City Flamenco Competition, which is a high honor. And also, he was asked to be a principal dancer in LA Opera's performance of Anadamamar, and that's an opera that features flamenco dancing. So our own Jack Harwood was there dancing on Los Angeles stage, premier performance. So it was a very cool thing happening in Santa Barbara in the flamenco, Bellascardo, August the 4th. Now, Richard, it's going to set you back a little bit because the parking and the ticket together is $225 each. But I'm going to say it's going to be a total night to remember for sure.
I would say it would be worth the money, especially if that's something that you absolutely enjoy watching.
Oh, for sure. I mean, look at what we throw our money away on. And this is, if you haven't been up to Bellascardo for one of these premier performances, they have beautiful food, beautiful wine. Of course, it's the best view in the entire world. And they do a tour. So if you get there a little early, they're docents who are really, really pleasant. They'll grab you and take you on a tour of some of the house if you're there early for the performance. So usually the people start arriving around 4:30 or so. The performance usually starts around 7. So if you're there a little early, you know, get yourself, in this particular, it's flamenco, so get yourself a margarita, some nibbles, et cetera, and then try to find a docent that'll get you into the house for a quick early tour. Absolutely fantastic. Another cool thing happening in Santa Barbara is the City of Santa Barbara Cultural Grants have just been announced that people can start applying now. There's $250,000 available for community support, for organizational development for a not-for-profit arts organization. They'll pay for a staff, for example, to be counseled how to do that. There's going to be money set forth for community events, for festivals, and for community arts in general. So there's three separate buckets of money that Santa Barbara's setting forth for the arts, which is great. And then I wanted to just talk a little bit about outside of Santa Barbara, outside of Los Angeles, Southern California. The largest new museum to open in Europe is opening in an old, it's in Belgium, and it's opening in an old former Citroën garage. Now, that kind of rung a bell with me, Richard. I had an old Citroën when I lived in England. I had one of those Citroëns that had a, the shift lever was in the dashboard. And it was, it had a motor that was the size of my father's lawnmower back in Illinois. Its motor was tiny, tiny, tiny. But the Citroën garage in Belgium, they're opening that. It's called the Canal Architecture Museum because the famous architectural firm of Canal is doing that museum. And it's going to be called the Canal Center Pompidou. That particular museum, I don't know how to translate this to square miles, but it's 40,000 square meters. So 40,000 square meters, John, how many 40,000 square meters is how big, you know? Well, come back and tell us.
She's consulting her computer, in-house computer.
Yeah, something that it's absolutely... Anyway, the museum is scheduled to open November 28th. Very, very cool. It's going to be cool. However, tragedy, of course, struck so many of these French or Belgian museums. Tragedy is striking lately, and they had a fire a couple of days ago there. So we'll have to see what happens with that museum. It's saying that nothing happened as far as injury or damage to the artwork. So, but keep your eye on that space. The Canal Center Pompidou. Okay, Smithsonian here back in the United States has had a big controversy lately. And I can only tell you, Richard, this is craziness, but the White House report was published not too long ago, maybe this past week, saying that the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian was promoting extreme political activism. Okay. And they disliked, the Smithsonian. The White House disliked that the Smithsonian wasn't patriotic enough, in their opinion.
Wow.
And so they published a massive report that was directed towards the Smithsonian's secretary, who is Lonnie Bunch III. And this is the Smithsonian responded on the 4th of July. Oh, excuse me. The report from the White House was sent to the Smithsonian, ironically, on the 4th of July. And it claimed that the Smithsonian National Museum of American History adopted, and I'm quoting, adopted an ideological framework that no longer treats the American story as shared national inheritance to be taught or celebrated, but teaches history as a political instrument to divide, dispirit, and discourage our citizens.
Wow.
And so the White House decided that they were going to opine on the kind of exhibits that the National Historical Museum of the Smithsonian, which has been around, since the mid-19th century, at least, they were going to opine on what they could and couldn't show. And so the head of the secretary of the Smithsonian, who is Lonnie Bunch, I mentioned before, sent an email that was obtained by the Washington Post saying that the White House's publication was not a fair characterization of the work and totality of the National Museum of American History. Well, I wanted to read you all the response by the Smithsonian. Dear colleagues, as you might have seen on July 4th, the White House Domestic Policy Council released a report about its ongoing review of the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. We continue to review the report. While there will always be room for improvement, this report is not a fair characterization. At the Smithsonian, our work is driven by scholarship, accuracy, and a commitment to tell the fullness of America's story. We are public servants and the keeper of this institution. We're charged with helping a nation find understanding, hope, and clarity. We remain focused on what grounds us, a commitment to scholarship, independence, accuracy. For 180 years, the Smithsonian worked alongside government, from the White House to Congress and the governing board of regents, to ensure the mission increases and diffuses knowledge. We want to serve the American public with clarity and care. This past weekend offered a vivid reminder of the purpose. Visitors from around the world gathered on the July 4th celebration marking the 250th anniversary, and they passed through our museum. They passed before a rare copy of the Declaration of Independence, encountered the bison sculptures in the National Mall, and stepped into the future in our newest galleries at the National Air and Space Museum. History and possibility stand side by side, and none of this happens without the people. The Smithsonian is the glue that holds the nation together, and because of the people's dedication and care and the belief in this institution, it makes the Smithsonian possible. And so what I did when I read that was I subscribed, even though I'll never get to Washington in the near future, to see the Smithsonian in person. I have in the past, when my son lived in Washington, and I upped my subscription, and I urge everybody that has ever seen the Smithsonian and enjoyed it to do the same. Anyway, that's just a little bit of the news in the art world, continuing on with the robbery at the Louvre. Moving now to France. Okay, so I think I talked about this to you, Richard, in a past, you know, state of the art interview we did. There was a huge robbery in the Louvre mid-October 2025. Thieves disguised as construction workers stole $102 million in the French crown jewels. They broke into the Louvre and stole jewelry from the French crown jewels. Still haven't been found. How this happened was an amazing story, because the security was so lax, they say, that it wasn't till a cleaning lady came in the next morning that she discovered a few jewels laying on the ground and a couple of busted cases. How does this happen at the Louvre? Anyway, it made me think about other heists from the very same museum, from the Louvre. And I want to talk to you, Richard, about one incredible heist. Let's see if you can guess. The famous theft at the Louvre took place in 1911. And the main thief was an Italian employee of the museum, Vincenzo Perugia. What did he steal? Any thoughts, Richard? What do you think this man stole in 1911 from the Louvre?
Well, I often wonder, is it strictly for money? Stole it because he's going to resell it? How would you do that without getting caught? Because now everybody's going to be looking for it.
What did he steal in 1911?
And I'm not sure what that was.
The Mona Lisa.
Oh, my heavens. And that's why she smiles the way she does. She's not happy.
So this thief in 1911 stole the Mona Lisa. Let me tell you what happened here. Before the Mona Lisa disappeared in the hands of one of the Louvre's employees in 1911, another gentleman confessed that he had been visiting the Louvre and had been stealing small artworks and artifacts from the museum for years and selling them to local dealers. This inspired the Perugia theft. And Perugia benefited from the Mona Lisa's low profile at the time, because it's very small. And at the time, it wasn't considered very important. It wasn't considered Leonardo's best work. It wasn't considered one of the greatest paintings of all time. And you might want to check this book out. It's The Crimes of Paris, A True Story of Murder, Theft, and Detection. The French Capital's Turn of the Century Underbelly. 28 hours later, employees of the Louvre, 28 hours, 2 days, they discovered the Mona Lisa was missing. How do you overlook the Mona Lisa? But they did. And the French press got a hold of this and went nuts, saying that, we should not have this happen. We should. And the American paper said, well, since our American millionaires are buying French fine art, why don't we just buy it all so these thieves won't get to it? And it caused an international battle. It also people claimed that the thief probably was a collector, J.P. Morgan, who had a collection of French art. So when you ask the question, how was this thief going to sell or display, et cetera, all kinds of speculations ensued. Pablo Picasso was accused. Nuts. But anyway, people were looking for somebody to accuse. I don't know, Richard, this is radio, but I downloaded a picture of the people. Can you see the...
Yeah.
There's the Mona Lisa, and there's all the people in their top hats in 1911 after they found the Mona Lisa at the Louvre.
Wow.
Of course, it wasn't found at the Louvre. It was actually Perugia made it to Italy, and he hid the Mona Lisa, and he discovered it became too hot to handle. He waited 2 years. He brought it to an art dealer, and the art dealer reported him. He was sentenced to 8 months in jail. The Mona Lisa returned to Paris, where you see the people that in that photo I just showed you, they were happy to have her come home. But he got 8 months in jail for stealing the Mona Lisa. I mean, in 1911, this was a theft, probably one of the world's famous thefts of the Mona Lisa. While we're there, I wanted to talk also about some of the French museums that are having some problems like this, where security has become very lax. I don't know. And people, have been known to attack various pieces, for reasons of environmental concerns, et cetera, et cetera. So, museums are really, as we have learned, at kind of a tipping point. Here's an interesting story about an artist. You asked me a while back, Richard, about an artist who sold a work that was a live, I guess, banana that was taped to a wall. And this banana sold for big bucks. So the banana, it says, let's see, the banana was, how much did that sell for? I'll come up with it. Oh, yes. 12.1 million. The banana that was taped to the wall sold for 12.1 million. And this was an artist named Maurizio Cattelan, who made his name with the sale of a banana. And the banana, was supposed to go rotten, which it did, and it was taped to a wall. And it was featured at one of the Art Basel shows, etc. And was purchased by a .com guy. And anyway, this is a story about the artist. So Maurizio Cattelan is now developing a new installation. He's moved on from bananas, and now he is going into a work called The Confessional. What is The Confessional? Okay, so all during the month of April, and anybody with an app called WhatsApp could see a live stream event in which the artist, Maurizio Cattelan, is dressed as a priest behind a white wall. And anybody that wants to can come sit in front of the white wall with a small opening in the wall and whisper sins in the artist's ear. And this is a, it's called The Confessional. And the artist will then either broadcast the sin or absolve you of your sin. And so, you know, this, really? This is it. No, this really happened. Yes,
oh,
indeed.
Heavens.
And it was documented well. The art priest absolved the callers. Yes, there was also a phone. You could, if you wanted to, you could phone in your sin. And yeah. So this was marking the 21st anniversary of John Paul's death. And I will tell you that the same artist made a sculpture of John Paul II. And that sculpture was part of the installation. And in truth, there are pictures of the artist on one side dressed in a priest's robe with a rosary, and on the other side, somebody telling the priest their sins. Who divided what? Well, the Catholic Church didn't like it, I'll tell you that. And they actually mounted this exhibition right around Easter on top of it, of this past year. The artist didn't know which side he was on because of all the controversy gathered so much information and so much notoriety for him. He's been an enfant terrible of the contemporary art world. You know, he had the 18-carat full-functioning toilet called America in 2016. And then, of course, the best-known work was the banana duct tape to a wall called The Comedian, 2019. It sold for millions, as you know. So the latest installation sculpture is called The Confessional. And if you haven't seen it, go ahead and look at it on YouTube and you'll see the artist absolving people of their sins. I think you're telling me we have to go to quick break. I'm going to tell you about what the American Museum of Natural History is doing with American Indian cuttings of hair from the 19th century. You hanging by a hair, didn't I, Richard?
Yep. I don't have any, so not really.
I know that's true. American Museum of Natural History is repatriating, in other words, giving back indigenous hair clippings that should have been returned under a 1990 federal law. And I found this article in the New York Times. Museums interpreted the law as applying to human bones. You know, you had to give the ancestors' bones back. Mm-hmm. Well, that didn't necessarily apply to all human matter. For example, we'll say that it'll apply to bones, but maybe not hair, maybe not fingernails, etc. Well, in 2024, an update to the law clarified that matter. All human remains must be repatriated unless they have been naturally shed. Okay. The museum right now, as we speak, is revising its inventory, and they're returning 2,700 hair samples collected for the 1893 World's Columbian Exhibition in Chicago. So for that exhibition, they had a particular hall that showed 2,700 clippings, snippets of American Indians' hair. I don't know why, but they did. And the lawyer for the Association on American Indian Affairs has said, you know, this is interesting because after 30 years of knowing the hair sample was part of the collection of the American Museum of Natural History, just now, after 30 years, they're getting around to returning those hair samples to the tribes. Doesn't raise a lot of trust in
no,
my mind.
But then again, there hadn't been a lot of trust on the part of the Indians towards shall we just use the term, the white man?
Well, that goes back to the 19th century. But I mean, today to have this sort of thing happened is, you know, this is kind of this. And I just want to mention a couple little things that came to my attention. Just a few days ago, an order from Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott said that the Black Lives artist mural was to be overpainted. He didn't like it. They were going to paint over the Black Lives Matter mural in Austin, Texas. On the other hand, a Santa Monica resident last year started a fair in Paris called Post Fair. He started this fair in a post office, small post office in Santa Monica, which was celebrating all things, you know, Paris and American together. Well, now he's expanding this particular concept to Paris, which is fantastic. So we've got a Californian man doing a fantastic revamp of, you know, the City of Lights, a beautiful fair. Okay, so Belgium, we talked about the fire of the museum in Belgium. Well, this is the good news about Belgium. Hyperallergenic, this is a magazine that I love. It has to do with things happening in the art world. The country's national soccer team of Belgium is called the Red Devils. I didn't know that.
Wow.
They advanced to the World Cup quarterfinals. They beat the U.S., as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a jersey designed by, well, in absentia, designed by the surrealist painter René Magritte. So Magritte is the one that's famous for his the Treachery of Images of 1929. It's the tobacco pipe image. And underneath the tobacco pipe, an inscription reads, "This is not a pipe, you know. Say and ceci n'est pas un pipe. This is not a pipe."
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Belgian team thought, okay, this is the most famous Belgian artist probably in the world, so let's do a jersey. And Adidas sponsored this. The inscription on the inside of the jersey reads, "This is not a jersey."
Cute.
And on the jersey, there's a circular motif, which is the like the ball, right, a circle, and it echoes Magritte's Voice of Space, which is a ball hanging in the air in 1931, a metallic sphere in a clear blue sky. You know how he did the blue skies with the clouds, Magritte did, and mm-hmm. it's over a grassy landscape. So if you look at, like, YouTube, now you can see some of the Belgian team, the Red Devils, and you'll see the jersey that says, this is not a jersey. After Marit's famous claim. Yeah, it's fantastic. Now, Richard, have you and Amrita ever visited the Sistine Chapel?
You know, it is on our list, but no, we have not.
Okay. So before you go, you need to take a shower.
Okay, no problem.
And that is because conservators right now, this began in March of this year, conservators right now are removing layers of dirt from the Sistine Chapel ceiling, which is, of course, the beloved Michelangelo fresco. This is a landmark restoration of the Last Judgment. So the Last Judgment is the one that's right overhead and all the tourists stare up into that sacred space, etc. And the Vatican Museum, of course, owns it and directs it, etc. She actually has described the restoration project as battling salty white accretions. And they had no idea where this white film came from, which obscures the detail of the mural. And it's the Second Coming of Christ. It's, you know, it's a 16th century work, etc. Conservators gave a press conference. They had forensic scientists. They had all kinds of people trying to figure out where this white film came from. And their scientists explained that 25,000 tourists, 25,000 each day, get into that chapel. 25,000 tourists pass through the chapel each day, and as their sweat evaporates, it rises and condenses. You've got 25,000 people passing through on a hot Italian day.
Wow.
And this, yeah, the sweat, I know, the sweat evaporates, rises, and condenses and reacts with the calcium carbonate because it's a fresco on the walls and the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. We have in our sweat this thing called lactic acid.
Right.
So the acid is there eating away. And what is happening now, of course, many people say this is not happening, but I'm here to tell you it probably is. In the last 10 years or so, this problem has gotten worse, much, much worse. And the conservators are racing to get this lactic acid thing under control. Why in the last 10 years has this problem gotten worse, Richard?
Well, I can certainly tell you that it is probably due to our diet and environment. I don't mean in terms of, you know, pollution, what have you. I'm talking about in terms of the environment in which we live, the things that we now eat, and so on and so forth. I think that's what it is.
Well, they're saying they're actually saying that the temperature in Vatican City has risen because of global warming so decisively that those tourists sweat more.
Ah. Okay.
Uh-huh. And so the restoration of the Last Judgment is supposed to be completed, but for now, the visitors to the Sistine Chapel gaze at a reproduction that was superimposed on a screen that covers the temporary scaffolding. You can go if you want to see this conservators up there on the same scaffolding, you know, that not the same, but similar scaffolding to the one that Michelangelo used when he actually painted that. Christ is hovering at the composition center. The arm is lifted in a commanding pose. He's casting judgment on the human race, etc. And the Vatican conservators are busy at work restoring Raphael's paintings in the Hall of Constantine. I mean, I had no idea that 25,000 people that passed through caused such a problem with sweat. Okay, quickly, I want to tell you about 10 of America's most beloved structures that are compromised. So to mark the 250th year of independence, the World Monuments Fund, the WMF, has published a paper throwing a spotlight on 10 of the most historic spaces that are urgently in need of preservation that various government agencies have declined to help.
Hmm.
And so what do you think some of them are? You know, the director of the World Monuments Fund, which is huge. It's a huge thing. And it's a great thing. They publish an annual list. Their list includes endangered heritage sites from across the globe, Buddhist grottos in China, Incan roads in the Andes. And then in a new initiative, they have decided to publish a treatise on irreplaceable America. And they have highlighted the landmarks that have contributed to our heritage. They say at the beginning of this treatise, heritage is non-renewable. Once a place is gone, the knowledge, memory, and meaning it carries cannot be recreated. Okay, so they have compiled a list of irreplaceable American constructed buildings. They had 75 nominees from all over the world. People gave their most, you know, treasured buildings that were in threat. They had an independent jury of historians, architects, and heritage experts weigh in on the basis of community significance, cultural significance, urgency, and community benefit. Okay, there's a pair of 17th century churches in the American Southwest that were built following the Spanish conquest of modern-day New Mexico. They're constructed out of adobe and stone. That is one that they've said is practically falling apart, needs to be helped. The Ancoma and Laguna missions, are the names of these missions. They are telling the story of colonial evangelical movements and the impact on indigenous communities. That is one of their top lists. The African Meeting House, which I've seen in Boston, built in 1806, the oldest surviving Black church building in the U.S., the center of the abolitionist movement, launching pad for the New England Anti-Slavery Society, hosting Frederick Douglass, Maria Stewart, and some of the great Black orators of our time. This is actually at risk as we speak. I.M. Pei designed another building I've been to, the Dallas City Hall. It was constructed in the wake of John F. Kennedy's assassination. The city sought a rebrand, and the structure looks like they demolished that old structure. They built this new structure. I.M. Pei was the architect. It kind of looks like an upside down triangle. It goes up and out. That is in peril. I don't know, Richard, can you see the picture? That's the building that I'm talking about.
Yeah, Dallas. I've seen that.
Have you? Okay, so that's Dallas City Hall, and it requires $345 million, and it's a significant work of American brutalist architecture. But it's in an area of Dallas that everybody wants to build high rises upon. So I'm not thinking it's going to have a really good future. What's that, Richard?
I was just going to say, I'm really questioning the ability of our architects and engineers in the 21st century to build buildings that are safe. You've heard the story about the building that's collapsing in New York.
Yeah.
It's like, and then the one in San Francisco. We got it coast to coast, ladies and gentlemen. What's going on?
The issue is there's so many things at play. I mean, not to mention, we just have that discussion about why the last 10 years the Sistine Chapel has been beat down so tragically. There's all these things that, as you say, that, the way we are, the way humans are, the way the environment is, the way building codes are, you see. And so, what's another one? Bauhaus architects built the famous Black Mountain College college dormitories. It was an experimental North Carolina institution. It was a hotbed of all kinds of art and artists, 1930s to 1950s. It is now suffering from water damage, probably going to go the way of the rivers there. It was designed by Lawrence Cockler. Joseph Albers taught there, William de Kooning, John Cage, Robert Rauschenberg, Keith Nolan, Kenneth Noland, et cetera. Another famous building I know real well, Watts Towers, a work of folk art in South Central Los Angeles, begun in 1920 by Sabato Rodia, an Italian immigrant. They're those spiky towers that you see in South LA. They are actually going to seed terribly. Bartram's Garden in Philadelphia from the 18th century, the nation's oldest surviving botanic garden, is going away. Colonial buildings in Newport. The entire historic city of New Orleans is at threat because of global warming and the sea rise raise. Dayton Aviation Site, where the Wright brothers began their first human flight, is actually at risk. And the New York Roosevelt Island 19th century hospital there, the first site of the nation's first smallpox hospital, is at risk. So these particular buildings, these are 10 of the buildings that the World Monuments Foundation in America have identified. They actually want to raise about $125 million for some of these sites. And the site path will vary site by site, but each of them, we hope that the American public will come to the fore and actually realize that once these famous buildings are gone, the Watts Towers in LA, for example, just around the corner from us here in Santa Barbara, once they're gone, they're gone. Anyway, Richard, any comments? Which was your favorite story today?
comment I would make in regards to especially the last one. I understand how man's desire to preserve history and those things that are important to him and her. But let's just take the last 250 years of this country, and we have preserved over the 2.5 centuries a lot of places here in the continental as well as the contiguous U.S. There has to come a point where we say we can't save it all. We know it's important, and I'm not being insensitive here. I'm being practical from that standpoint. I remember in Phoenix where they wanted to preserve and make historical landmarks of this building and that building and the other building and another building. And it went on and on and on. I'm going, you're not going to have any room for residents, retailers, commercial, industrial, anything, because you've saved everything as a historical monument. So there has to come a point where we say, we know it's important. We'll take lots of pictures. We'll do a lot of 3D with drones so people can see it on the computer or on big screens. But we can't save it all. I mean, hey, I want to save my childhood home. I want it to be an historical monument. Okay? It's in the middle of a neighborhood.
Well, so let me just say, you know, for about 35 years, I've been a card-carrying and big supporter of National Trust for Historic Preservation. And I've gone to a lot of their conferences. And over the years, I can only tell you the collection, I guess the mission statement for what we're going to collect and conserve has changed drastically. And it used to be, you know, anybody's childhood home was important. But mm-hmm. now the scholarship on the matter has refined it so much now. And I've actually seen it happen over the times, you know, that I've attended the conferences for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. So it's got to be a combination of things that make something historic. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the spotlight then is on historic places that are irreplaceable, that have contributed to a certain special U.S. narrative as cultural identity. So they've got to be in peril, for example, to be looked at closely, given. But what would it take, for example, to say what knowledge is there, what memory is there, what meaning is there, and on many different levels, you know, culturally, architecturally, impact on community, impact on the nation, impact on a certain part of the subsection of the nation. So, you know, and also things that aren't built, like, for example, the Botanic Garden in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a garden where the same species of plants have been curated since the 18th century. So, yeah, so it's like, how do you determine and what, you know, what's your advisory committee determine? So, mm-hmm. in one era, maybe somebody says, well, this is the way I think it should be. In the next era, it's totally changed. It's becoming more and more a combination of a lot of different disciplines and a lot of different experts that get together. Likewise with the World Monument Fund, you know, there's all sorts of experts from architects to city planners to historians to members of outsider communities, you know, to climate scientists, to this, to that. There's a whole bunch of people that get together, not to mention some of the, you know, concerned parties. We have the same thing happening right here in Santa Barbara where, okay, should we save the Gaviota Cliffs or should we let them go to a developer? Should we save, you know, parts of the Hope Ranch beaches or should we let them go to be developed? You know, and so there are, what you bring up is really salient, that there are certain decisions that need to be made wisely. And yes, you're right. The goalpost changes as that kind of curatorship develops over time. But it is developing, I think, in the right direction because we're starting to realize it's not just one opinion. There's many opinions that go into what's going to be some kind of, you know, raised to monument status, you know.
Yeah.
So I like your point. Yeah. Anyway, there's the story of the art world happening in early July 2026.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And poignant, too. Poignant, too. The thought also occurred to me in this same discussion. We have had not necessarily 47 men, but 47. We've had up to around 46, 45, 46, 47 presidents. Each one of them is going to want to preserve, and maybe has, their childhood home. Like Lincoln, he preserved his log cabin, right? It's a historical monument. What happens when we reach 100 presidents? Or 200, if we get that far, 200 presidents. What about the congressmen and the senators? I mean, there comes a point where we do have to, and like you say, the criterion is starting to be fine-tuned to where we're making better decisions in that regard. And that's a good thing. That is a good thing. Well, very interesting program. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Richard.